Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports. I'm James Robinson, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Paul Beston about his book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. So a few words about Paul, who thank you for coming on to the program.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So Paul Beston is a managing editor of City Journal, and his writing has also appeared in City Journal, The Wall Street Journal, Pop Matters, The American Spectator, The American Conservative, Real Clear Sports, The Millions, The Christian Science Monitor, and others, including the anthology Da Capo Best Music Writing 2003. He also holds a MA in English from Fordham University. He has published boxing essays for The Sweet Science, as well as the publications above. So in addition to that introduction, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your academic path, and where you're from, et cetera.
Sure. Well, I'm currently, I'll start from the present and work backwards, I guess. You know, I'm a managing editor with City Journal, as you mentioned, which is here in New York City. I've been working in New York City one way or another for my whole working life. I don't live here anymore. I live north of the city in Beacon, New York. My parents are originally New Yorkers, but I grew up in the Midwest in the Chicago area before coming back east. But it was when I was growing up that I got interested in the topic that is, you know, the subject of my book, boxing. So my interest in boxing goes back many, many years. But, you know, in terms of academic path, I was an English major, classic sort of English major who couldn't do math very well in college. And I did pursue graduate studies for some time at Fordham University, got a master's degree, did a little bit of work on PhD, but then opted to take a different path. And, you know, here I am at 2017, still with the City Journal. I've been here at City Journal for 10 years and was working on the Boxing Kings over the last 4 years or so, and just published this past September.
Great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How did you come to write The Boxing Kings? You'd mentioned that you've been at City Journal, so obviously you're a writer. But how did you start on the project? The subtitle is When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. How'd you get on that?
Well, I've been writing and publishing articles for about 15 years or so, and I just on a variety of things. I'm definitely a generalist. You know, I don't have a specialty area. If I have a broad specialty area, it would just be America and Americana, American culture, American history. Those are things that interest me the most. And one thing I noticed as I started writing pieces and essays and book reviews was that boxing just kind of kept popping up because it's an old, very old passion and love of mine dating back to boyhood. And I found that whenever I was kind of, you know, stuck on ideas or whatever, it always seemed as if boxing was a very fertile field for me to go back to write something on, whether it was a new book out on one of the old champions or just some other topic regarding the sport that I could tackle. And so about five and a half years ago or so, I was realizing that I'd done quite a bit of writing about these guys, these heavyweight champions in particular, who are in my book, who I call the Boxing Kings, the heavyweights. And I thought, you know, maybe I should put all this together in a book. And I also began to realize that there hadn't really been a book that has done this, that puts all of them from the late 19th century, starting with John L. Sullivan, who's really the first key guy, all the way through the whole 20th century, and ending pretty much at the doorstep of the 21st century with the end of Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield's careers. Because the other, as you said there with the subtitle, the key hook here is the American angle, because obviously there's still a heavyweight championship of the world that's still going on, but it has left the United States, and it has been essentially an international property now for a decade and a half or more. And what I realized once I started putting the book together was that that's a pretty new development, essentially, through the whole 20th century. Although it was called the Heavyweight Championship of the World, it was really an American thing. There were only a couple of international champions. So I was struck by that, and I was struck by the opportunity it provided to not only tell the story of these champions, but you know, do a little bit of history with them. Because one of the things that made the title so alluring to me, I realized that reading about it as a kid, was what larger than life figures these guys were, and the way that they, the most significant ones, always seemed to connect with their eras in some way. They either reflected their eras or sometimes even influenced them in some ways. And so I saw the opportunity to tell the kind of a parallel story, both of the title itself, but also of the growth of sports in America, and of, you know, some social history in the country as well during the 20th century that is reflected through these guys' careers.
Okay. So let's go into the meat of the book. How did boxing evolve? Why was it so dominant in American culture, and why did the...
Well, it evolves. It comes from Great Britain. I mean, the roots of boxing, you know, go back to antiquity, really, with Greece and Rome. But then it essentially died out for a long time, at least as best we can tell from a historical standpoint, chronicling it. And it was really Great Britain around the 18th century that begins to resuscitate the sport. And you know, obviously America is a British colony, and this habit comes our way as well. And just as it's starting to kind of lose momentum in Victorian England, it really starts to catch on more in the United States, starting around the middle of the 19th, even a little bit earlier in the 19th century. It just had these sporadic bursts of events that caught people's interest. But it was an illegal sport. It was always illegal for the 19th century. So it was its appeal was limited for obvious reasons. But at the same time, it was capturing working class enthusiasm in real great intensity, especially as the immigration to the country began to increase in the late 19th century, especially with the arrival of the Irish diaspora from around 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And it's at that period that John L. Sullivan, who I mentioned earlier, who was the son of Irish immigrants, who was born in 1858 in Boston. So he's a first-generation American of Irish descent. He really rises to the top and becomes, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world. But before him, they had been champions, but they hadn't attained the kind of fame and influence and riches that he did. And he really took the title into a whole uncharted territory. He made this a commercial kind of institution, a real enterprise that you could actually get rich doing. Before that, most boxers were, you know, they're kind of dying in the gutter kind of thing. They weren't making great money. And Sullivan was making, you know, Sullivan was becoming a rich man as the heavyweight champion. So he's a key figure, not only in the heavyweight title, but really the rise of American sports. You know, why did the title stay here so long? I think it's a very much a reflection of that immigration. There are so many groups coming here, and it's just a lot of it is tied to the nature of our society, of this you know, an ascendant culture where people are coming here and scrapping and trying to rise. And boxing was just a really key vehicle for that in the late 19th century, and also in the first half of the 20th century. It started to reflect the immigration pattern. So the Irish with Sullivan, and for a generation after that, are great, greatly representative in boxing as champions. But it's often forgotten today is in the early 20th century, Jewish fighters were very prominent. When there was a lot of, you know, great Jewish community in the Lower East Side, and great fighters coming out of New York from poor homes, you know. And then later on, the big wave of Italian immigrants came, and that gave us a very famous heavyweight champion later in the century, Rocky Marciano. So you can really kind of trace these immigrant groups moving through America, and boxing is a very interesting mirror of watching that unfold. And I think that it was tough for other countries to compete with that, because we were welcoming so many different groups here, and there was such a culture of aspiration in America that boxing, I think, played into.
Okay. So thinking about some of those names, you named John L. Sullivan and Rocky Marciano. thinking about some of the other ones like Jack Johnson or Jack Dempsey or Joe Lewis. What is each of these champs? One of the themes of the book is that it's a sort of crowning of individuals who pass on the crown. So it's a many short biographies. So what does each of these champs and big names say about each of the eras?
Well, they're very evocative of their times. I mean, I mentioned Sullivan. I mean, he comes in the Gilded Age. It's a time of growing American wealth, but it's also a real transitional point where he's really kind of the first working class celebrity. I mean, America still hadn't really had that kind of experience yet, and he's kind of a precursor to great athletes and movie stars of what we're going to see in the 20th century, and again representing that ethnic group of pride that he did. When you get to some of the black champions such as Jack Johnson, you're in there's a whole different story there, because you're Jack Johnson's career. He was champion from 1908 to 1915. He's the first black man to hold the title, and so his whole career is kind of a mirror held up to American society of what the racial climate was, and it wasn't a very happy picture. He won the title by beating a white fighter, and Jack London, no less a great novelist such as Jack London, writes from ringside, "The white race must be rescued, and we need a white champion to come out of retirement and beat this guy. We can't have a black man holding this title." And that reflected two things. One, it obviously reflected the racism of the times, but secondly, it also reflected how already by 1908, the heavyweight title was seen by people as this important thing that had to be protected. You know, this is American, somehow it belonged to America, and we can't let it fall into the wrong hands. So that those kinds of feelings were already there as early as 1908. And so Johnson, somebody like Jack Johnson, really, as I said, was reflecting, was really a lightning rod for what was happening in the country then, which is, I mean, it's a terrible time, really, racially, a lot of reversal of progress that had happened in the late 19th century with Reconstruction and then terrible lynchings going on in the South. And, you know, he's the kind of guy who had death threats against him pretty much every fight. And then he was also breaking all kinds of social taboos, such as his relationships with white women. So he was just a figure of unbelievable contention in the early 20th century, and he was handling it with an incredible amount of audacity and courage. And so Johnson is very significant in that regard, but his career is so notorious, at least by the way whites look at it, that it cost blacks, at least in the heavyweight division, because once he had passed from the scene, there was kind of an unspoken agreement. You know, never again. We're not going to let that happen again. So it took a generation before another black man got a chance at the title in the 30s, and that was Joe Lewis. So, and Joe Lewis, in terms of representing the era, he's, again, just he's a great figure of black pride at that time. He's very different than Jack Johnson. He's not as flamboyant. He's not flamboyant at all, actually. He's quite stoic, soft-spoken, doesn't involve himself with white women, at least not publicly. He is gracious and dignified, and he does not ruffle the feathers in the way that Jack Johnson did. And so he is able to fight for the title and win. He's pretty much unbeatable at his peak. So his merits as a fighter are, you know, nobody can deny them. The other thing that happens with Joe Lewis is his career starts to intersect with these other big, big events that along with his personal dignity as a person and as a champion, start to really work subtle social changes in people's attitudes for the good. And I think one of those really key moments is when he is matched up against German fighter named Max Schmeling, who was at the time kind of the favorite of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany. This is 1938. People have been debating ever since then, you know, how closely and how willingly this fighter, Max Schmeling, was tied to the Nazis. Was he going along willingly, or was he being kind of adopted against his wishes. Whatever your views on that, he lands in America in 1938 for this fight with Joe Louis, seen by most Americans as Hitler's fighter, and rightly or wrongly. And so it's a fight that takes on an incredible amount of political and social ramifications. The Nazis with all of their master race talk. So certainly for blacks, seeing Joe Louis win is of huge importance, but also for American Jews, rooting for Joe Louis with great passion to see him win this fight and somehow, stick it to Hitler, at least in the boxing ring, because, we're right at the doorstep of World War II here. The war was going to start barely a year later. June 1938 is when they meet. And Louis just destroys Schmeling, knocks him out in 2 minutes of the first round. So, but what happened in the fight is that, according to the newspaper, Chronicle the fight shows is that millions of Americans rallied to Louis's side who were neither black nor Jewish. They were just, a lot of white Americans came to see Louis as an American like them, and decided that they wanted to see the American win over the German and Hitler's fighter. And I think that's an important, it's a subtle kind of thing. Not that every white person was rooting for Louis. That certainly wasn't the case, but certainly more were rooting for him than might have been expected. And that's a key moment for him in his career. And a few years later, when the country goes into war and Louis suits up in the army, he does not see combat action, but he's a kind of a morale officer and fights exhibitions and entertains troops and visits troops and flies all around the world visiting GIs at army bases. Again, another crucial sort of bridge building to white America. By the end of Louis's career, he's got people at ringside, white fans at ringside, rooting for him against white opponents. And I think that's that shouldn't be remarkable to us. It's certainly not remarkable now. But when you think about Jack Johnson, who I mentioned earlier, that would have been unthinkable in Jack Johnson's time. And that had only been 30, 35 years earlier. So it's a big change. And lastly, for just on Louis, I think it's often overlooked today that he paved the way for Jackie Robinson. He was the heavyweight champion 10 years before Jackie Robinson got into baseball. And in fact, Robinson is quoted as saying, that he wasn't sure if that day would have ever come if not for Joe Louis. So I think he's a huge figure in the history of sports in the country. And I think maybe sometimes a little bit overlooked by now due to possibly boxing's fading a little bit from prominence. But there's a bunch of other guys. I don't know how much if you want me to go through them all, but, obviously Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, let's hear about them. I mean, I think that's one of the strengths of the book is that even the bigger figures are sort of connected by I guess, flashes in the pan.
Well, Dempsey, in terms of his era, I think his significance is that he is really the bridge to modern commercial era of sports that we know today. Because when he's the champion for most of the Roaring Twenties, which means he is a sports contemporary of Babe Ruth. And Babe Ruth, nearly 100 years later, his image, his fame, his reputation seems to me hardly diminished at all. I mean, he's little kids probably still know that name. His presence is very clear at Yankee Stadium. His fame remains. And Jack Dempsey, though, I think his fame has probably faded quite a lot. And that's striking again about maybe there's another story there about how boxing has lost prominence, because during the 20s, Dempsey was every bit as famous and celebrated as Babe Ruth, and certainly far richer. He made money that no other athlete of the 20s could even approach. I calculated that in his richest fight, which was in 1926, when he made $717,000, which doesn't sound like much today, but it's a whole lot in 1926, is more, almost more than Ruth made in his whole career. Season salaries all added up together. The most Ruth ever made in a season was $80,000, and he only made that for, you know, three or four seasons. So Dempsey was just operating on a whole different financial plane as heavyweight champion. And he was also the guy who brought in these immense crowds, promoters, custom-built stadiums because of the crowds that wanted to see him. He fought before crowds of over 100,000 people. That kind of size is only seen today in a couple of those huge college football stadiums like Michigan and a few others. This is for a boxing match. Most of today's big boxing matches are in Las Vegas, and they may seem like a big deal, but there's probably only about 10,000 people inside of that hall. We're all paying money on pay-per-view and all the rest of the money is certainly ringing up, but in terms of bodies, there's just nothing quite like looking at an old picture and seeing the immensity of the crowds that used to come out and see him. So he's, the 20s brought in radio, and they brought in this sort of more and more newspapers had their own sports sections. And by the end of that era, you really start to recognize kind of the sports landscape taking shape that we're more accustomed to today. So I think that's really Dempsey's enduring influence, because he was such a gate attraction. He attracted people in such huge numbers.
Skipping back ahead after Joe Louis's Rocky Marciano, like you had mentioned before.
Right. Yeah, Marciano was champion. He's a major champion, but he was champion not for as long as some of these other guys, only about three and a half years. He came to boxing kind of late. He wanted to be a baseball player. He wanted to play baseball, and he was a pretty good baseball player, but he wasn't good enough to make the Cubs. He tried out for the Cubs. He's actually a pretty good football player in high school too. So he saw sports as his way out. He was the son of pretty poor Italian immigrant parents. His father worked in a shoe factory, and his son just was haunted by that life that his father led and desperately wanted to escape from it. And boxing was the final shot there in terms of sports. So he got to the game late. He was he had physical limitations. He was quite short, 5'10", very short for heavyweight, very short arms. So he had to fight inside. He had to get close to his opponent. He had to be willing to be hit, and he had to just work himself. I would say there's no heavyweight who ever worked harder than this guy. His training camps are legendary. His stamina and endurance are legendary. I watched his YouTube fights, and there are these rounds where he has a guy pinned up against the ropes, and he is throwing punches literally nonstop. I'm waiting for him to stop, and he just doesn't. I don't know where he gets the oxygen from, but he was profoundly well-conditioned, and just he did it. He achieved what he achieved through absolute determination, just iron will. And he's famous today for a couple of things. One is this number, this zero, this 49-0 record, 49 wins and no losses. And he's the only heavyweight champion who never lost. And has a funny way of coming up again in sports sometimes. Just last summer when Floyd Mayweather was fighting that big fight against some people thought it was a big fight and other people thought it was a farce. But anyway, a lot of people paid for it against Conor McGregor. And Mayweather was 49-0. He was looking to win his 50th. And so people were – Rocky Marciano's name was back in the news. And it does pop up from time to time. But he's also just a – he really fit in with his era, the early 50s, the beginning of the Eisenhower years. He was very modest. He was very humble, hardworking, close to his family, close to his community. This is very, very fitting of the times. And I've been in Italian restaurants even now and seen his picture. So, his presence does remain.
Yeah, there's a – where I'm from, Philadelphia, there's a statue of him in South Philly. Mm. I believe that's Rocky Marciano.
Yeah, might be. He was from Boston, but then maybe there's a I know there's a statue of Joe Frazier in Philly, which that's fairly recent. But that's another guy. He's not – I don't know. Did you want
to? Let's move to the next, the big one.
The big one. Well,
one of the big ones. Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali.
That's just Clay Muhammad Ali. I mean, that's like, you know, I can almost do a separate podcast, yeah. Right? I mean, he's one of these guys. He and Mike Tyson behind him. When I've given talks on the books, on the book, I always tell the audience to say, yeah, "Now, these last two guys, I know that you know. I know you know these last two guys," and usually they do. When I think of Muhammad Ali, I think backwards. Again, sometimes it's easier to start and work backwards. I think of his death last summer, and I think of the incredible media extravaganza that was. It was, I don't know if you remember, but it was about a week of coverage on cable news and you know, the internet and everything. And I also remember, because I knew that he was passing, that he had been sick, and so I knew that I was going to write something about him. And I remember going to sleep that night, looking at my phone, you know, seeing if it had happened yet. And I woke up in the morning, and he had passed away. And the headline of the New York Times was just remarkable. It was Muhammad Ali, Titan of Boxing, End of 20th Century, dies at 74. And I thought, well, that's what a second clause, you know? I mean, and that was what he would have loved that, because that is what he always said. You know, I'm the athlete who gets written about on the front page. All these other suckers get written about on the fourth pages. I get written about on the front pages. And, you know, it was true. You know, it's impossible to summarize him, but I could really just pick two giant legacies of his. And the first is, obviously, he brought a level of showmanship and self-promotion that, I mean, there's just sports had never seen anything like this guy. And I would say he's never really seen anything since, but so much of, you can see through the promotional activities of athletes today and showing off and showboating and just trash talking and promotion. And he backed it up. Of course he backed it up. But he also had so much charm. I mean, I'd say in the book that he brought something not normally associated with prize fighting, which is joy. I mean, he made people laugh, you know, and that was remarkable. And then, of course, the second thing, of course, is, you know, the political and social elements. No athlete. I mean, sports have been entangled in politics before. We were talking about Jack Johnson. We were talking about Joe Louis. I mean, the politics in the world outside do come into sports more often than we would like to admit, and more often than some of us enjoy. But it never really been blended and embedded in the way that Muhammad Ali, the whole arc of his career, really did, both through his first joining the Nation of Islam and the racial issues that he addressed, and then, of course, his refusal to serve in the armed forces in 1967 when he was called for service. So those are two, you know, and again, these are things, like most big American lives, these are things you can, there's plenty to argue about. I mean, there's lots of different opinions about it. Ali's arc of his career is fascinating, because these were hugely contentious things in the 60s, and he would eventually be much more celebrated than criticized for those things. And he really won millions of people over through both through changes in the culture and through his own force of personality and sincerity. So you know, it's a giant legacy. I don't even know how to wrap it all up, except to say this fall with the NFL national anthem protests, you know, if there's a shadow of one person that hangs over all of that, it's Muhammad Ali. I think I just read this morning that Colin Kaepernick won the Muhammad Ali Award from Sports Illustrated. So that's how contemporary he is. He's very much embedded in the kind of sports world that people watch today, for better or for worse, depending on how you see these things.
Yeah. So the last big figure who I remember quite well, and I don't think anybody's really come close since, and you kind of wrap it up in the book with Mike Tyson, and he serves as sort of the bookend of the American century of domination.
Absolutely. I would say nobody attracted people to the boxing ring to watch fights in quite the same electric electric kind of way, as Mike Tyson did since Jack Dempsey. I mean, Ali did, but Ali did it in different ways through his personality and his self-promotion. And you know, Ali was a brilliant boxer, but he wasn't always, you know, his fights were not always, you know, he wasn't a knockout fighter. He wasn't known for a heavy punch. He drew people because of a whole constellation of things that made people want to watch. So Tyson drew you there for one, with one key way, which was that this was, he's just a destroyer. And that has always brought people into the seats in boxing. That was how Dempsey did it, because people had never seen an aggressive fighter quite like Dempsey before the 1920s. And in the 1980s, nobody had seen someone fight like Tyson before. And in fact, the Dempsey analogy was one that Tyson was emulating himself. His early haircut was almost a mimic of Dempsey's, that just shaven on the sides. He liked to walk into the ring without robes, without the robe, just the trunks, just ready to fight. He saw that as another kind of Dempsey adaptation. So, and of course, the other real analogy to Dempsey is that he liked to end a fight as soon as possible. That was what Jack Dempsey always wanted to do if he could. And Tyson and Dempsey are the two guys who scored the most first round knockouts among all these heavyweights. So the thing with Tyson, I remember, you know, I was in college at the time, it's just nobody wanted to miss the fights. Nobody wanted to miss him when he was on. And everybody knew, you know, make, you know, don't be late, you know, because you might miss it. And that's a special kind of electricity to have. So he was just a giant draw. And he brought a lot of excitement, but of course he also brought this incredible personal turbulence. And he came from such a difficult background, which he's written about now in his memoir, Undisputed Truth, which is you know, it's a very long book. It probably could have been a little bit shorter, but the early parts of it are really compelling. If I would recommend people read it, those early chapters when he describes his childhood are as harrowing as really and sad as you're likely to read of a kid who just you know, doesn't have any examples other than pretty negative ones to look after. So, you know, his career has that this kind of Dickensian arc to it of coming from rags to riches and being found by this great mentor, Custamato, a great old boxing trainer who trains him in the Catskills. And it has this whole Hollywood sort of quality to it. You know, he sees Tyson as a 13-year-old kid and says, that's going to be the next heavyweight champion of the world. It almost seems like somebody made that up, and yet that seems to have been the case. He recognized this greatness in Tyson as a kid. And Tyson becomes a boxing historian himself. So he's watching all these old films and reading all the old books, all about these guys from the past who he's hoping to emulate. So his story has all this weight to it. You know, when he comes in and gets the title, it almost seems as if he's destined to be here, you know? So, but then it all just blows up. It all blows up because of his, you know, his personal demons. He's unable to keep his life together, and he loses some good people close to him who are going to look after him. And then after that, it's just a roller coaster ride, and eventually it's a real crash and burn scenario where he hits the bottom in 1992 when he's convicted of rape. He had already lost his title by then in a shocking upset in 1990 to James Buster Douglas. But his life just starts to spiral downward. He gets convicted of rape. He serves a 3-year prison sentence. He comes back in the mid-90s and is involved in several other huge gazillion-dollar fights with Evander Holyfield. And again, infamy starts to follow him around. I mean, the infamous moment where he bites Holyfield's ear, and he just becomes increasingly kind of like a tabloidish figure, just almost cartoonish villainy, and just seems to be a kind of a person imploding before our eyes. And then have, of all things, this he emerges from the depths and has apparently turned his life around and starts this whole second act or third act. I don't even know how to number them at this point. But, you know, he obviously, as he wrote about in his book, he did all kinds of serious therapy. He was remarried, I guess, 8 or 9 years ago. Seems to be a doting father to these young children he has, and people are rooting for him. You know, he's become a kind of sentimental favorite. People will root for Tyson, and his Broadway show was very popular, in which he talks about his life, and he even makes people laugh now, which is remarkable. I mean, it's a remarkable arc of a life, and in many ways, it kind of to me exemplifies the whole modern celebrity, you know, so ups and downs and crashes and huge riches and bankruptcies and reversals of fortune and shame and redemption. And his life has got it all in there. But he is really the last, American heavyweight champion who captures people in that way. And Evander Holyfield is eventually his conqueror. And Holyfield's an interesting guy himself, but he doesn't have that same kind of hold, on American fans that Tyson did. And then, a few years later, Lennox Lewis first becomes champion. He's from Great Britain. And then eventually, the title was taken over by these two Ukrainian brothers, the Klitschkos, Vladimir and Vitaly. And Vladimir in particular held it for close to a decade or so, and now it's still, the title is back in Great Britain now. So it's really Tyson and Holyfield, that's really where the American line ends. And at this point, that's right around the turn of the century. That's going on 2 decades now. So it's been a long time that the title has left the United States. And for more than a century, the thought that it wouldn't be in the United States would have been unthinkable to people.
Mm-hmm. Why, after so long, then, has boxing suddenly moved away from the United States? Is it something to do with the decline of boxing as a sport in the U.S., or maybe the rise of boxing in Latin America and Eastern Europe and U.K., or something else?
Yeah, I think those are some reasons. Sure. I mean, boxing's been, depends who you talk to. Boxing's been in decline for a large part of its history. I mean, it's never really surpassed its kind of mid-century peak, I'd say, maybe the 40s, maybe the early 50s. But from around the mid to late 50s on, it was really, it's had a very slow descent. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one reason that people don't always think about is that up to about the mid century, boxing didn't have a lot of competition. The number one sport was baseball. Baseball was always number one, but boxing was basically number two. It was hugely popular. Everybody followed it. The NFL was, there was an NFL, but it wasn't a serious competitor. College football was more popular than pro football back then. The NBA, same thing. It was around, but it was a small kind of thing. It wasn't, didn't have the kind of popularity. And, starting in the 60s, the NFL really takes off. In the 1960s, the NBA starts to take off. So there's a lot more competition for people's sports dollar. And boxing is just terribly run. It's just never had a commissioner, never had somebody like Pete Rozelle, who's just such a brilliant commissioner for the NFL, it was really kind of organized anarchy, or disorganized anarchy, and of course corruption. I mean, there was mob elements in boxing going way back, starting around the early 70s. These multiple organizations start coming in and naming their own champions. So you have these divisions that have multiple champions. Nobody knows who the real champion is, and the sport just really is shooting itself in the foot left and right. You have bad decisions, you have corruption, you have deaths in the ring, a lot of stuff to deal with. And what held it together, just it's staggering through that period, was the heavyweight title. The people like Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, George Foreman, Larry Holmes, Tyson, and then at the lower weights, that great last period in the 80s with people like Sugar Ray Leonard and Thomas Hearns and Marvin Hagler. But it was an uphill battle. The sport is another big thing that happened around in the late 80s is it left free television. You know, when I was a kid, I got into the sport because it was available on television. I grew up in an age before cable, hard as that is to believe. And, it was there, but it left regular television and moved to cable entirely. and pay-per-view, and I think that closed itself off from its audience. So it's just a lot of different factors. But you mentioned, you know, globalization. I think that's definitely been a factor too. You know, you look at these guys that won the heavyweight title in the 21st century. They're from Ukraine. Ukraine's, you know, they wouldn't have been in the running back in the other, you know, the earlier part of the history because of the Iron Curtain and all that. So there's a lot of factors, but American fighters are still. You know, Floyd Mayweather's an American. There's great American fighters at the lower weights. People have been trying to answer the question why Americans are not in the heavyweight division. And I have to confess, I've never really heard an answer to that that I find satisfying. I'm really not sure what the answer is. What I've heard more than one person say is that big guys have other options now. They can play basketball or they can play football. I don't know. I've never found that super convincing, but it could be right. You know, football is going to face its own problems now because of the head damage issue. So, you know, we could have a lot of different changes going on in the years to come in terms of the sports that are accepted and not accepted. You know, so I mean, as bad as boxing has governed itself, in some ways, I think. Some of this was inevitable. Another factor I didn't mention was this has always been the sport that attracted the poorest kids for the obvious reasons. You don't go and become a fighter unless you have to. And the standard of living in America from now going back to the early 20th century, you know, it's risen dramatically. And I just think that there's been less need in the cities of you know, for boxers than there were at, say, the turn of the 20th century compared with now. It's just there are other sporting options. You know, back in boxing's heyday, there was plenty of poverty to send kids to gyms, and there were plenty of gyms. You know, there aren't as many boxing gyms as there used to be. So,
right. And it faces challenges from other fight sports like MMA.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I see MMA as a symptom of boxing's decline, not a cause. I think MMA came about. Best my memory serves is about the early 90s, really, when it first started to percolate up. And I think it just moved into the vacuum that was being left by boxing. I mean, boxing had left TV. So right there you have an opening because it's not on regular TV. And MMA was very savvy. See, as like I mentioned, the commissioner before, this guy, Dana White, you know, he's look at what he built. I mean, it's pretty effective, and he marketed it very effectively. And he gave fans the fights that they wanted. You know, boxing is also notorious for not giving fans the fights they want with the, you know, these top guys who they want to see fight, and they can't make a deal. And it's, you know, it's very frustrating for people who follow it. So yeah, MMA I think rose up because boxing was losing people. Whether the two can go head to head in some way and boxing can come out ahead again, I think, you know, remains to be seen. Boxing has had a couple of good years. It's had a couple of fights recently, as people know, that got people kind of excited. And, you know, when I'm reading around these days, I see boxing writers feeling more encouraged that the sport is on a bit of a roll and might be building some momentum. So, you know, we'll see. But it certainly did dig itself a hole. In many ways.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about the overall history of boxing in the United States, we've talked about the big names. What are some of the smaller names that sort of stand out to you? What I like that you do is between the big names, you link them with some of these smaller figures. So, yeah, do you have any ones that particularly stand out to you?
Sure. You know, one of the joys of working on the book was just really all these guys, as you said. I mean, these mini biographies. I was hard pressed to find any of these guys who were dull or unsympathetic in some way or other. So, you know, the guy who jumps out to me is a fighter from the 20s named Gene Tunney, who was from New York City, and he was the guy who went on to defeat Jack Dempsey, which through most of the 1920s was thought to be impossible. But the remarkable thing about him was that he was not only a great boxer and a great champion. He saw boxing. He had this whole vision of his life that he wanted to bring to fruition, and it involved making $1 million and retiring from boxing before he got hurt, so that he could, I'm exaggerating a little bit, essentially so that he could read books and improve himself. And he was a son of, you know, relatively poor parents. He had become fascinated with literature as a young man, but he didn't really have the schooling, and he was busy trying to advance himself as a boxer. And he had this big vision for his life. And first it involved beating Dempsey, which he believed would bring him about $1 million and allow him to retire comfortably. And he did this. He defeated Dempsey not once but twice. He got his $1 million. He married a Carnegie heiress, so he put his money together with hers. And he did go ahead and become a kind of student of the arts and become friends with people like Thornton Wilder and George Bernard Shaw. And Yale once asked him to come and lecture to the class about Shakespeare. So he's a very atypical a boxer. And for those reasons, some boxing fans didn't like him because they thought he was being a little bit above his station. But it's a pretty remarkable story. Another guy is obviously George Foreman. I mean, closer to our present day. And that's another guy who kind of this whole arc of a life, you know, his first career is this young knockout fighter. He's just terrifying to get in the ring with. And he's never a bad guy, but he was not the friendliest. He was an intense young guy, surly, and he loses this very dramatic fight with Muhammad Ali in Africa, the fight known as the Rumble in the Jungle, where Ali famously leaned on the ropes and let Foreman swing away at him until Foreman was exhausted in the heat, and Ali knocked him out. Foreman, a year or two after that, retired from boxing at a pretty young age and became a born-again Christian, and stayed out of boxing for a decade. And people had long since stopped wondering whether he would ever come back. And then all of a sudden, just as they assumed that he would never come back, he did come back, pushing 40 years old, overweight, looking very different, bald, shaved head, and jolly and friendly and funny and making jokes about his weight and about his love of cheeseburgers and all the rest of that, and becoming, within a few years, this loved, hugely popular figure, completely different than the guy who'd been around in the 70s. But beneath all that joking, there was a very serious determination to win that title back, and by God, he goes ahead and does it at the age of 45, the oldest guy ever to do that. So, and he's, you know, he's gone on and become an entrepreneur. He puts his name to this incredible product that becomes known as the Foreman Grill, which is just this phenomenon, which ends up making him more money than he even made as a boxer. So he's had a pretty remarkable life as well. But there's a whole bunch of guys in the book. I enjoyed delving into all the lives. I found, you know, there's a story behind all of them. There's a background behind all of them, you know, and one of the things I was writing about in the introduction is that, you know, we see boxers as these gladiators and all this, which they certainly are, but, you know, you peel back the layers and these are people like the rest of us. They've got parents, they've got fears, they've got insecurities. They've got all the stuff that regular people do. The only difference is they've got to work out those fears and insecurities in front of tens of thousands of people. And, you know, it's a daunting thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've taken up a lot of your time, Paul, but thank you so much. So what's next for you? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm trying to think of what my next project should be. I'd like to work on something like this again. I love doing this. You know, I don't know if I'm finished with this topic or not. I kind of assumed I was when I was working on the Boxing Kings. I thought that I'd put it all together and wrap it up. But you know, there's a lot of different stories in here that one could certainly take in a different direction and explore individually. So I've thought about that. I haven't really come to any decisions yet about what I'll do next.
Okay. Well, Paul, I'm sure whatever you decide, it'll be another page turner. So watch out
Thanks.
For Paul Beston. And I want to thank you for coming on the show today. It was really great. And yeah, take care. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, James. Thanks for having me.